welcome back to Shattering Mist. Nick, before we continue to talk about the possibility of reincarnation, I want to go back to your original premise, where I concur that God did not tell us everything, mainly because there's many things that would be beyond our understanding. But here's what I also know, that everything he did tell us is true, and that he did prove that he was God in his revelation, and that he told us everything that we needed to know to make a decision in this life whether or not we wish to engage in a relationship with him or not. And under that understanding, Nick, if reincarnation, if we had second and third opportunities to make the right decision, and so that depending on how many lives we were given, we had either several or a score or hundreds of opportunities to get it right, and all we had to do is one time get it right, and if the next time we came back and we got it wrong, or we would never come back if we ever got it right, that kind of information would be essential. And God doesn't give us that information. He doesn't say anything that remotely would infer that that is the case. And so since I know for certain that what he said can be relied upon, and that he told us what we need to know to make a decision if we want to be part of his covenant family, I think I would rely on that rather than the rather remote possibility that reincarnation is true. Now, one last thought, Nick, and then I've got Kirk on the line here, and that is that I during the break I had 7 or 8 minutes to read, and I read a number of in-depth articles by those claiming to take a scientific investigation towards these stories, the kind of stories that you've mentioned, and most of them are reports that take place in Turkey, of all places. And there's been a number of cases where a child in a community reports that they have some knowledge of the circumstances surrounding a dead person. And I read through the much of some of these articles as much as time as I could in the break. And boy, I tell you what, it looks awfully lean to me. I'd be really careful about basing my the future of my soul on the possibility that these are valid.
Well, thank you for taking your time to speak with me.
And I've been, by the way, Nick, you are always welcome on this program, and we will always devote time to your questions. They are always thoughtful, and I have grown to appreciate you, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye. With that, we have another favorite caller, a good friend, a member of the Covenant family, Kirk, who has called in from California. Where are you in the great golden state of California?
Up in Northern California in Folsom.
Oh, okay.
35 years in Orange County, and we kind of semi-retired. I thought I was retiring until Obamacare hit me, but I'm still working
yeah.
A little bit, but I don't have to work quite so hard as I when I had all this.
Okay, so you're up at Folsom, huh?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's one of my favorite albums, of course, was recorded at Folsom Prison. I'm sure you've seen the movie Walk the Line, know of the history. And you don't all have that same dirty water now up there in Folsom, do you?
No, it is really gorgeous up here. We've had that little drought, but it's not. It's been raining, so everything's getting full again. So I'm an artist, so I came up here ready to paint in my old age. So
I didn't know you were an artist.
That's what I do for a living.
Oh, really? What kind of art do you create for the most part?
Well, I started out as a magazine and book illustrator and painter, and then when I came out to California, I wind up owning my own art school and gallery and all that sort of thing, and sold a lot of stuff in Laguna and things like that. So,
I've got to tell you, Kirk, you may not know this, but I am there are three groups of people that I am shamelessly envious of. I'm shamelessly envious of people who have great athletic skill. I mean, I would love to have been able to make a living playing golf, for example, or baseball. I tried too in high school, and I was always good enough to make the varsity team, but never good enough to be a star on that team, much less to go on. And so I tried too, but it wasn't in the cards for me. And then the second is that I dearly love to sing, but I can't carry a tune in a bucket. And so I'm envious of those people who can really sing, because I think it would be just be a wonderful thing to do, be able to do. And the third is that, I've spent most of my life in marketing, where conveying ideas visually is important. And I've always been reliant on those who had the skill to do so. I can envision it in my mind. I can communicate to the artist what I want to see, but I have no capability whatsoever of drawing it myself.
It may be why I like the Paleo Hebrew, because the symbols and all that is intriguing to me, more so than just any regular alphabet. I mean, that's pretty impressive stuff.
Yeah, for all of our listeners, and most probably know this, but the original language of Hebrew, the original alphabet, in fact, man's first actual alphabet, was a pictorial alphabet, where the letters not only conveyed a sound, but they also conveyed imagery. And the interesting thing is that if you want to know the meaning of a Hebrew word, you really don't have to look it up in a Hebrew dictionary. You just can look at the original letters. And Kirk is correct. They are all designed to convey what Yahweh had in mind. You just look at the first letter. It's the first word in Hebrew. Okay. It's based upon the first two letters in the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph and Beth. And it's Ab. It's the Hebrew word for father. And it's interesting that in the language God created, the very first word is how he most wants to be known, father. And that's telling by itself. But you look at the visual depiction of that most important title, father, and you find that the first is a picture of a ram's head. And the ram's head was designed to show capability. You know, it was the ram was is always viewed as this enormously capable animal that was through the ram that whatever needed to be done to protect a herd or flock could be done. The ram was a leader, and the ram was fully capable. And then the second letter is Beth, which was drawn in the form of a home, a protective enclosure for a family, with a single entrance or doorway. And you put those two things together, and you have the Hebrew word father. And then you add El, which is the word for Almighty, and you add the power and capability, the leadership capacity of Aleph. This time you add Lamed, which was drawn as a shepherd's staff. And the shepherd's staff was designed to convey that the one who would lead us, the one who would protect us, the one who would nourish us, the one who would guide us. And so, you know, with every word in Hebrew, the word itself is defined by those graphic illustrations.
We have the little charts, and then you can literally go down with every letter and write every possible meaning for that letter, and then you just take a word and you do all that, and you get a deeper understanding of the word just by breaking it all down per letter.
Yes, and maybe you're even talking about the charts that are prepared for the introduction to God. It's in the
words. Yeah, I have a couple more. So it's everything, and then you look in your dictionaries and all, and you can just keep on going, and it's like, wow.
Yeah. One of my favorite is Beth. You know, Beth and Bereth are two of the most telling words in Hebrew. One is family, and the other one is family-oriented relationship. Bereth is the Hebrew word for covenant. And, you know, you look at the letters that comprise it, and you can understand what it's all about. I mean, it begins with the word and the letter that means family, that depicts home, you know, that the graphic depiction of a family home. And then, the next letter is the Hebrew Yad, which is God's hand, reaching down and out to us, the open hand to just as a father does to the children in his home, to guide them, to lift them up, to hold them, to cherish them, to nurture them, to feed them, and, you know, all of the, to lead them, all the things that, that an open hand from a father does. And then in and Bereth, the Hebrew word for covenant, the Rosh is the next letter. And, you know, here you have this particular family identified. It's the first family. It's the most important family. And also, and even the last letter, the death, you have God's signature on it, his mark, his affirmation that everything about this, all the promises he has made regarding the covenant family, come from him and are therefore reliable.
This is more fun. I wanted to address, though, a couple things on
okay.
that Nick had said, just because it may be interesting.
Okay.
They did a lot of studies on, I don't read a lot of that stuff, but once upon a time I'd run across some things where someone would claim all their past lives, and then they'd put them mm-hmm. into hypnosis, and they would find that there were books that they had read or things that they came out that they had memorized or whatever, knowingly or unknowingly, and they were telling the story that somebody had recognized in a book.
Right.
And then there was, it was presented to me one time that we know that people can be demon-possessed and demons
Correct.
That live eternally.
Right.
They're going to be in a closed-in space once, but they live eternally. So if they had
right.
possessed someone before, they knew
right.
about their lives, and if they possess someone now,
right.
they would know about those lives as well, so their information would sound rather incredible.
Right.
It wouldn't necessarily be the person.
Yes. As a matter of fact, Kirk, if you can stay with us, in the articles that I read during the last break, there's a third example as to how this information is passed on, and I'd like to share it in terms of people almost always growing up in proximity to the deceased individual and the information that families just naturally pass on that is absorbed by other members of the family. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shamremus. We have Kirk on the line, and we are now discussing the some of the explanations that that create the very thin support for reincarnation. And the really, I think, Kirk, you've done enough research into this, and what little I've done also confirms that really the only support there is for reincarnation is these very infrequent and rare incidences, usually in third world countries, and today mostly in either India or Islamic countries, whereby a young person will claim to have knowledge of a deceased person's life. And as you say, when there has actually been a scientific investigation of their claims, like they are put under hypnosis where they have less control over sourcing, they'll admit that, I read a book on it. That's how I came to know. The other means is, of course, in demon possession, of course, and particularly in the Islamic world, would be rife. But the other means is that our lives leave an imprint. There's so much that can be known about us, particularly when we live in fairly primitive communities. The more primitive the community, kind of the more people are likely to know a little bit about the community's past and the people who live there, because there's not so much clutter. You know, in the world of Folsom might be a beautiful place, but there's still a lot of clutter, a lot of distractions. But in the countries where these things occur, typically they're fairly primitive, not a lot of clutter, and it would be natural for those growing up in those communities to know a little bit about their ancestors and about what the community was like previously, because it's just part of the fabric of those areas. And the reports that I have read, that is the primary means of these young peoples making such claims and having such knowledge. It's just what is known communally.
Well, you know, there's one other thing I was going to mention just for perhaps for Nick. My great aunt used to write all that stuff down from Edgar Casey used to when he'd go into a trance.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he did some remarkable things, you know, approaching miraculous, you know, as far as health, to helping people with their health problems,
mm-hmm.
when you really study stuff, this is a demon-possessed guy. So if you, you know what happens sometimes, somebody does something wonderful and then everything they say becomes overly popular or they mm-hmm. believe it to be the truth. So
mm-hmm.
they give a lot more credibility to that than they would normally had he not done all the things that he did. So when you run across things like that, you got to be, in my opinion, you got to be real careful not to give them more credibility than they have just because.
Yeah.
In fact, we think doctors are God sometimes, you know, and that sort of thing. So
one of the things, too, is that, you know, you read Yahusha's commentary at the end of his Sermon on the Mount, where he has talked about the influence that the wolf in sheep's clothing is going to have on Christians. He's speaking, of course, of Paul. And he's telling them that those who call him Lord, that don't know his name, or that don't know Yahweh's name, are going to be excluded from heaven. And then these Christians, they come back and they protest, and they not listening because they'd never listened to him, you know, call him Lord, Lord again, just after he told them, no one calling me Lord is going to enter heaven. Yeah, the door's closed. If you refer to me Lord, the door to heaven is closed. But they, you know, they're not listening to him, so they say, Lord, Lord, again. And they say, you know, haven't we done these mighty miracles in your name? Haven't we driven out demons in your name? Haven't, you know, we established great proclamations in your name? And he says, no, I don't know you. Get away from me. And this is the a ploy, I think, that many deceivers have used. First, there's sleight of hand that creates the impression of a miracle. There's sometimes just knowledge that can lead to surpassing people's ordinary understanding. That was used all the time in pagan religions where, you know, they would build a fire inside of a graven image and put a little water in it and put a whistle in its nose and, you know, it would scream out at the people and scare them, you know. So, I mean, there's lots of things that, you know, gunpowder that would create a flash, you know, and scare people. There's lots of that, and there's lots of healing that takes place through science and through diet, through medicine, through, in fact, even the right kind of attitude can make a tremendous impact on a person's well-being and their recovery from disease. And so there's lots of things that people can do to create the impression that they are trustworthy when they're not. More on this when we return in a moment. Welcome back to Centering This. We're having a conversation with Kirk, and we're talking about the basis for reincarnation. And I think, Kirk, your last point, which was that that either through demonic inspiration or through just physical knowledge, that you can create what appears to be miracles to deceive people. It could well be the few unexplained cases in terms of reincarnation. I think I'm like you, Kirk, in the realization that we give Satan and his demons far too much credit. I think they do a lot less than they are blamed for having done. But that doesn't change the fact that that there are thousands of them, that they do possess individuals, and that it is in their interest to make their most effective tools, people, therefore, political and religious leaders, seem credible. You know, Paul performed miracles And yet Paul most certainly had no relationship with Yahweh. He was overtly opposed to Yahweh. And Paul actually admitted the reason he was able to perform miracles. He said, I'm demon possessed. And so, yeah, I think there is a fair amount of that. And that's why there are things that that appear miraculous, that are designed to appear miraculous, to give credibility to religious and political and military leaders. And, if you're moved by them, be careful.
And many people are. I mean,
yes.
Show up at all the services, the healing services and so forth.
Oh, boy. Benny Hinn was the number one guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Benny Hinn. When I was close to Jerry Falwell, we would talk about Benny Hinn because Jerry was not only knew Benny Hinn pretty well, both of them crossed paths a lot. Falwell once asked Benny Hinn, said, I admire your ability to have dinner and a show and to raise money based upon these healings, because you're making a fortune. He was flying around in a G2 at the time. So Falwell asked him, Benny, with all of these events and all of the healings, has there been one single person that you actually think you healed? And Hinn said, no, not one. It's all a show.
Isn't that amazing that he would say that?
Yeah. Oh, he admitted to Falwell.
Oh.
Falwell wasn't going to out him. Not one.
No.
Every single one of them was a fraud. And he knew it was a fraud. And by the way, every religious leader knows that what they're doing is a fraud. They know that they are lying. But it doesn't take much to fool people.
Huh? Kara and I talk about that. We say, do they really not know, or they just believe the lie so strongly that they've accepted it? They have to know.
I think there's a difference, Kirk, between religious leaders and the victims of the religious leaders. I think the victims
are the leaders would have to know.
They know. And I think that's the reason why God is saying that, getting right back to to Nick's comments, uh-huh. is that it is appropriate for God to hold the leaders who know better and are misleading for their own personal wealth and power, to hold them accountable. To send them to the place of eternal separation because they know what they're doing is wrong. And so to deal with them that way, which is why every pope is going to be there, every cardinal, every bishop, every televangelist, they're all going to be there. In hell, the place of eternal separation known as Sheol. But those that they have deceived, I don't think they know. I think that if you were to take the average Muslim jihadist, they've just been played for a fool. But if you take the imam, I don't think there's a single imam on the planet today that actually believes that the Quran is an accurate reflection of God's testimony. It's impossible to study it and to know what it says and to think it's true.
I have to run a little bit, but I wanted to thank you. I know when you went off on your vacation, you were kind enough to send me some stuff on Yashayah, and I appreciated that. We've been studying that, and that is powerful stuff.
Boy, yeah, we're talking about the programs that we've actually been doing, which are based upon a chapter.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the chapter that I have not published yet, which is on Yashayah 17 and 18. In fact, I spent 2 hours this morning continuing to add to that particular chapter. And I did send it to you before I left. For our listeners, and in the last segment of this program, I'm going to return to that text, and we're going to continue to cover it. And the reason it is so powerful is it is prophecy that is literally happening in our midst, and the prophecies are so unbelievably detailed and so all-encompassing about what's going to happen here in these last days that it's riveting to your soul. It's one of those things which said, if you've already come to know Yahweh and you are absolutely convinced that He is God and that you can trust what He relied, it's riveting in that, wow, He told us really everything we need to know.
And stopped you in your tracks. I mean,
yeah. Wow. And if you were of those that were still trying to make a decision, is this Torah and prophet God real? Can I trust what he had to say? There is really no way to listen to his testimony on how the Syrian war is going to eviscerate Israel. And lead to a regional war that turns into a global war, and walk away and say, well, this was committed to writing 2,700 years ago at a time when Israel didn't even exist. There is just no way that this was revealed by chance.
You can't hide this. No, it's right there.
No. Yeah, you can't hide this.
I must run. We appreciate you. We'll see you this evening. And look forward to seeing you tonight, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Kirk. What Kirk
yes,
is
sir.
Referring to is for the rest of our listeners. We on Fridays, we do a second program. It's on Blog Talk Radio, not on GCN. If you were to Google Yada Ya Radio, it would take you directly to it. But it is at 7:30 Eastern Time. On Blog Talk Radio, I do a program that is devoted entirely to the Torah and prophets. It has many participants. It has a very active chat room that's part of the program. And we spend an hour and a half on the dawn of the Shabbat, Friday as the sun sets, speaking about what God had to tell us. It is it's a marvelous way to begin each Shabbat, and we will do that again here in a few hours today.
All right. So thank you, here.
Thank you, Kurt. Returning to the prophecy, Yashaya. We were at Yashaya 17:7, and I want to jump right back in where we left off. God is saying, in that specific day, this man will genuinely regard and always accept the Almighty, his Maker, and his eyes will continuously look towards God, the set-apart one of Yisrael. So what day are we talking about? Now, this prophecy, we're now in the seventh statement relative to this prophecy. It began with God telling us that Damascus, which is the longest surviving, continuously inhabited city on earth, would fall, that it would become a twisted heap of ruins. He told us that the war would destroy Syria and that the Syrian government would fall. He told us, and this is a prophecy that was not only written 2,700 years ago in 750 BCE, but we have the entirety, the oldest extant and complete book from antiquity, happens to be the book of Isaiah, of Yashaya. It's you'll find it, and it's called the Dome of the Scroll. And there's an entire building that wraps around this one scroll. It's entirely intact from the first word to the last word. And that particular scroll dates to 250 BCE. And it's talking about events that we are witnessing today that would have been unfathomable even 50 years ago. And so after saying that the government of Damascus is going to fall, it talks about the collateral damage and the annihilation of the outcasts, the refugees who are in Lebanon and Jordan. Then it transitions directly to the thinning of Israel, which means that Israel had to be back as a nation and intact as a nation, had to return to very near original borders to be thinned at the waist, which is taking it back to the pre-1967 lines, which makes Israel only 5 miles wide as its waist, which, as the prophecy said, is unsustainable. God then speaks at this point of a harvest, of a gleaning, of 7,000 souls being removed prior to the beginning of a vexing time of great tribulation. And he will transition into an all-Islamic assault, a flood of Muslim mujahideen coming into Israel. But before he gets to the presentation of that onslaught of jihadists where 100 million Muslims or more are going to come into Israel as a tidal wave of violence, of rage. He, as a heavenly father, speaks of removing his children from the earth prior to this time of horrible trouble. And so here we have God doing exactly what he has promised. And now in relationship to this harvest, God is telling us that the conditions that are going to exist in heaven are going to be the antithesis of those on earth. We have our good friend Larry, who was kind enough to do several shows while I was gone on vacation, who has called in. And Larry is also my co-host when we do the Shabbat show on Friday evening, although he was the host of the show for the last 2 weeks. Larry, I hear the music playing, but right after the break, I hope that you can join us and we can talk about the difference that God is presenting between heaven and earth at this time. The contrast will never be greater between what man will do religiously and militarily and politically to fellow man on earth and what those individuals will experience who enter heaven. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering one of the most important prophecies, I think, in all of the Torah and prophets and in Psalms. And it's a prophecy that I sent you the rewrite of Larry just prior to departing on vacation. And I do very much appreciate the shows you did while I was gone.
You're quite welcome. I'm not sure how deep I got into anything, but hopefully it helps some. It's amazing. And again, it's just in the way Zechariah writes about fast flying war machines with drivers in them.
Yes.
In the battle of Armageddon. Here we have Yisrael being thinned at the waist. And, of course, it didn't exist as a country, 60 years ago.
No.
So here we're watching it all come together, and you can present this evidence to people. And I have done so and had them say, that's your interpretation.
What's amazing is
my interpretation.
At the time that the prophecy was being written, committed to paper, Israel didn't exist. The only aspect of Israel, at that time, what was called Israel, which was the Northern Kingdom, was completely gone. The people were gone. The cities were completely destroyed. There was nothing left of Israel at the time that this prophecy was written down. And the only vestige of a combined Israel, which would be the kingdom of Yehuda, was just Jerusalem, one city. And at the time that this was committed to paper, the Babylonians were on the cusp of annihilating them, and they did. And so, for better part of 2,700 years, this prophecy was impossible. There was no Israel to dissect at the waist.
Yeah, it's only possible in this last generation when he said he would bring all of his people back to the land. And this is the deal. This is what we're seeing. We're watching prophecy unfold in front of our eyes, and there are people that are just oblivious to it because they want to be.
You know, Larry, the other thing that's interesting here, too, and I didn't really catch it until this last time through, is that Syria didn't exist as a country until quite recently, because Syria, in fact, the Hebrew term for Syria refers to Assyria, and Assyria was destroyed at the time that this was being committed to paper. At the time, the Babylonians were pursuing the Assyrians, and they destroyed the Assyrians. They prevailed over them, and so Assyria, which is the Syria we're talking about where he says the government falls, it couldn't fall in the future because it had already fallen and it wouldn't exist again. There wouldn't be a rebirth of Syria, greater Syria, until the aftermath of World War I. 100 years ago is when it even became possible for the Syrian government to fall because there was no Syrian government. I mean, just so every aspect of this, and then you even get to the details about the nature of the nation across the sea, directly opposed to Israel, the opposite side of the world from Israel, and all of the specifics that are labeled against them. But even in their nature, God refers to birds of prey, to falcons and eagles and hawks, and you recognize that's what we have named all of our warbirds. I mean, our best fighters are eagles and falcons. That's what we have the most of. And the next onto them are raptors. And then we have all of the seahawks and various a hawk named helicopters.
The description of the helicopters, whirling and buzzing.
Wings. That lead this parade of violence and arrogance of America. And how they're launched.
Navy.
Yeah, launched from ships. Yeah.
Unreal.
It is so astonishing. It's so detailed. And the bottom line is there is no way to consider what God had to say with an open mind and not come as Nick did in his call up to us early. He says, you know, I've read the Torah. I can't find anything that's untrue in it. Can't find a contradiction in it. Everything that that God said proves that he is God, proves that he is right, that he told us the truth. And that's what's reaffirmed in all of these prophecies. That's why the prophecies exist, is to prove that Yahweh exists and that he can be trusted and relied upon. So, Larry, my good friend, are you going to be able to join me for our Shabbat show this evening?
I'll be doing that.
We'll all join together at that time. May Yah bless.